Welcome to the April 18th, 2024 episode of Blood Podcast, your source for innovative ideas and cutting-edge information. Our topics are based on articles published in Blood, a journal of the American Society of Hematology. First on today's podcast, gut microbiota exploitation by CPX351 in acute myeloid leukemia. In contrast to classic 7+3 chemotherapy, this liposomal combination of cytarabine and daunorubicin prevents mucosal damage, dysbiosis, and morbidity in preclinical intestinal inflammatory settings. Up next, optimizing anti-myeloma immunity. New research shows that regulatory T cells suppress myeloma-specific immunity during autologous stem cell mobilization and transplantation. Treg depletion removes these constraints, suggesting a new and clinically testable strategy to improve responses after transplantation. Finally, among pediatric patients with ITP or other autoimmune cytopenias, which ones will go on to develop systemic lupus? Investigators report that positive ANA is a risk factor for systemic lupus erythematosus, especially in children with an initial titer greater than 1 to 160 or age over 10 years at diagnosis. They recommend ANA screening and long-term monitoring in ANA-positive patients. Let's start with our first research article. CPX351 exploits the gut microbiota to promote mucosal barrier function, colonization resistance, and immune homeostasis. The first author is Giorgio Renga of the University of Perugia in Italy. This article focuses on CPX351, a liposomal combination of cytarabine and daunorubicin at a fixed 5-to-1 molar ratio. CPX351 was approved in 2017 as first-line treatment for adults with newly diagnosed therapy-related acute myeloid leukemia, TAML, or AML with myelodysplasia-related changes. In previous studies, CPX351 significantly improved overall survival as compared to conventional cytarabine plus daunorubicin, the standard of care 7+3 combination. It has a favorable safety profile compared to 7+3. With a lower incidence of fungal infections and infection-related mortality reported in real-world settings, as well as a 50% lower incidence of gastrointestinal toxicity. Here, the authors hypothesize that there is a causal link between the reduced gastrointestinal toxicity of CPX351 and the reduction in infection-related mortality. One potential contributing factor is related to the effects of different types of chemotherapy on beneficial microbes in the gastrointestinal tract. Cancer drugs may disrupt eubiosis, or the balance of the intestinal microbial ecosystem, resulting in dysbiosis, or adverse changes in gut bacteria composition, activity, or distribution. Dysbiosis has been linked to numerous adverse events, may compromise the efficacy of chemotherapy, and could promote drug resistance. Previous AML studies have shown that 7+3 induction chemotherapy disrupts intestinal microbiota. This dysbiosis was linked to higher infection rates, and in patients undergoing hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, low diversity in gut microbes has been associated with reduced survival. In the present research article, Renga and co-authors ask whether the favorable toxicity profile of CPX351 is due to differential effects on gut microbiota. They utilized preclinical murine models of intestinal damage and fecal microbiota transplantation to test effects on gut microbiota, mucosal barrier function, and fungal colonization. Altogether, they found that the liposomal dual drug formulation, CPX351, protected against gut dysbiosis and mucosal damage while increasing antifungal resistance. Mice treated with 7+3 developed intestinal dysbiosis that included expansion of proteobacteria, which is associated with inflammation and impaired intestinal homeostasis. The 7+3 regimen also caused severe intestinal pathology and increased intestinal permeability in mice. By contrast, mice injected with CPX351 did not experience intestinal dysbiosis, mucosal damage, or hyperpermeability seen in the 7+3 treated mice. In fact, the CPX351 treated mice had an expansion of the types of bacteria associated with a balanced microbiome, including Bifidobacterium, Prevotellaceae, and Bacteroides. The changes in microbial composition seen after 7+3 treatment correlated with microbial virulence and deregulated metabolic activity. By contrast, CPX-351 treatment was associated with signs of microbial eubiosis, such as healthy levels of oxidative respiration, genomic stability, and restoration of beneficial metabolic processes. In addition, 7+3 treatment impaired colonization resistance to fungi, whereas CPX-351 promoted resistance. Following CPX-351 treatment, investigators observed a relative abundance of microbial metabolites known to affect epithelial barrier function and colonization resistance to fungi. Further experiments revealed that CPX-351 may exert these protective effects through the aryl hydrocarbon receptor IL-22-IL-10 host pathway. CPX-351 activated this pathway both in mouse gut and human intestinal cells in vitro, the likely candidate for activation of the aryl hydrocarbon receptor pathway, according to investigators, is the liposome. Even empty liposomes increased aryl hydrocarbon receptor activation. And so, liposomes may be mitigating the toxic effect of daunorubicin in the intestine, breaking down a vicious cycle of barrier dysfunction and dysbiosis. Investigators say that altogether, CPX-351 helps to maintain the mucosal barrier and functional microbiota, which may contribute to its favorable safety profile and low infection-related mortality. Perhaps a simpler statement is that lipid coating soothes the gut. That's an observation from Renaud Buffet of the ALFA Collaborative Group in France. In a commentary, Buffet says these results are experimental, yet highly relevant clinically. They could help explain why CPX-351 may induce less gastrointestinal toxicity and less early mortality than 7+3. Which was suggested by the results of the CPX-351 pivotal trial and the real-world retrospective study. The study is not without limitations. For example, investigators did not document engraftment of donor bacterial strains over time. These data could be significantly different in humans and mice, and it would be helpful to have further data on the molecular linkage between the aryl hydrocarbon receptor pathway and the intestinal protective effects of CPX-351. Nevertheless, these findings should prompt further investigations. For example, studies of gut microbiota in AML patients treated with 7+3 versus CPX-351. Such studies would better characterize digestive or infectious complications, their impact on patient outcomes, and the impact of confounding factors such as antibiotic treatments that are likely to impact gut microbiota. The next research article is Regulatory T cells suppress myeloma-specific immunity during autologous stem cell mobilization and transplantation. And the first author is Shuichiro Takahashi of Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center, Seattle, Washington. For decades, autologous stem cell transplantation, or ASCT, has been the standard of care for myeloma consolidation therapy. ASCT significantly prolongs progression-free survival and may improve overall survival in patients with high-risk cytogenetics. It has been assumed that the success of ASCT depends on cytoreduction, but increasingly, evidence shows that the benefit is predicated on the development of anti-myeloma immunity after ASCT. Recent preclinical research shows that the benefit of ASCT hinges on the generation of antigen-specific CD8 T cells that can control myeloma progression. There's just one problem. Nearly all patients who undergo ASCT will eventually relapse, and myeloma progression after ASCT is associated with features of immune escape. This emphasizes the need for novel approaches to bolster anti-myeloma immunity after ASCT. Takahashi et al., authors of the current research article, previously showed in a myeloma mouse model that ASCT results in T-cell-mediated myeloma control after transplant, and furthermore, that subsequent immune escape was associated with T-cell dysfunction. In the present article, they focus on the composition of T-cell populations in bone marrow and mobilized stem cell grafts from myeloma patients. ASCT in myeloma patients is typically accomplished by stem cell mobilization, followed by collection of stem cells from the peripheral blood. The mobilized grafts include hematopoietic stem cells, conventional T cells, and regulatory T cells, Tregs. Some T cells may originate from the bone marrow, including some assumed to be myeloma specific. Of particular interest are the Tregs, which are key contributors to immunosuppressive tumor microenvironments. Tregs suppress the function of effector T cells and are implicated in inhibited CD8 T cell division and apoptosis of memory CD8 T cells. Now in Blood, Takahashi and co-authors describe factors that influence anti-myeloma immunity during stem cell mobilization and ASCT. They assessed the T-cell composition of bone marrow and peripheral blood stem cells in patients with myeloma. They found that mobilized stem cell grafts included high numbers of both effector CD8 T-cells and immunosuppressive Tregs that were originally located in the bone marrow but were then mobilized to the blood. The authors hypothesized that these Tregs were likely to compromise the beneficial effects of the CD8 T-cells. So what if these Tregs were eliminated? Investigators explored the effects of Treg depletion during stem cell mobilization in a preclinical myeloma model. By genetically depleting Tregs, they expanded polyfunctional effector T cells in the mobilized grafts. This enhanced tumor-specific immunity and control of myeloma after ASCT. Next, investigators explored Treg depletion strategies that might be practical in humans. First, they tried antibody-based approaches. However, antibodies only partially depleted Tregs. The effect was overall not sufficient to activate and differentiate CD8 T cells during stem cell mobilization. By contrast, they had success with NL-201, a CD122-biased IL-2-IL-15 agonist. NL-201 stimulates the IL-2 receptor on CD8 T cells, without binding the high-affinity IL-2 receptor utilized by Tregs. In the myeloma model, NL-201 efficiently expanded polyfunctional CD8 T cells in mobilized grafts, and not Tregs, and it protected against myeloma progression after ASCT. Beyond NL-201, other CD122-biased IL-2 mimetics are being developed and studied in solid tumor clinical studies. Based on this study, these agents may also be feasible for peritransplant use in myeloma. In a commentary, Heiko Bruns of Frederick Alexander University in Erlangen, Germany, says that Treg depletion supercharges ASCT power. Bruns says the authors reveal that T cells originating from the bone marrow migrate to the blood during stem cell mobilization, and they exhibit a preference for returning to the marrow after adoptive transfer. Furthermore, depleting Tregs during stem cell mobilization results in the expansion of polyfunctional effector T cells, enhancing anti-myeloma immunity following ASCT in the preclinical model. Thus, this study supports the hypothesis that in myeloma, long-term tumor control can be mediated by antigen-specific T cells. The study also strongly suggests that enhancing anti-myeloma activity during ASCT with NL-201, the IL-2-IL-15 receptor agonist, can be therapeutically beneficial. Altogether, Bruns concludes, these promising data provide a good starting point to use NL-201 in combination with these regimens in ASCT. Our final article is Anti-Nuclear 1 Antibodies Associated Autoimmune Cytopenia in Childhood is a Risk Factor for Systemic Lupus Erythematosus, or SLE. The first author is Jérôme Grenell of Bordeaux University Hospital in France. SLE is an autoimmune disease, most often diagnosed between ages 15 and 45. However, in 10 to 20% of cases, SLE is diagnosed in childhood. The course of childhood onset SLE is typically more severe than in adults. Pediatric patients often have renal and neurological involvement, and 10-year mortality estimates range from 8% to 19%. Most patients with childhood onset SLE present with hematologic manifestations. Among these are autoimmune cytopenias, which are associated with a more severe disease course. The autoimmune cytopenias include immune thrombocytopenia, or ITP, autoimmune hemolytic anemia, or AIHA, autoimmune neutropenia, or Evans syndrome. Conversely, some pediatric patients who present with autoimmune cytopenias will be positive for anti-nuclear antibodies, or ANAs, a characteristic feature of SLE, and a substantial proportion of children presenting with autoimmune cytopenias are at risk of progressing to SLE. For example, in small single-center or retrospective studies, up to 29% of childhood ITP cases are associated with ANA positivity, and of this ANA positive subgroup, up to 42% went on to develop SLE. However, more robust studies are needed to identify factors predicting progression to SLE in children with autoimmune cytopenias. Identifying at-risk children promptly could have important therapeutic implications. Some early data suggest that hydroxychloroquine, a well-established treatment for SLE, could be beneficial even earlier in patients at high risk of developing SLE. Accordingly, Grinnell and co-authors studied progression to SLE among individuals with ANA-positive childhood-onset autoimmune cytopenias. They studied a large French national observational cohort of children and adolescents with autoimmune cytopenias. Since 2004, the prospective cohort, known as OBS Servants, has enrolled patients under the age of 18 years who are newly diagnosed with chronic ITP, AIHA, or Evans syndrome. The present study focused on patients with ANA positivity documented at least once at diagnosis or during follow-up. ANA positivity was defined as a titer of 1 to 160 or higher. Of 1,803 children in observance, ANAs were positive in 355, or 20% of the cohort. With a median follow-up of 5.1 years, 79 of those 355 ANA-positive patients, or 22%, had developed SLE. By contrast, there were zero SLE diagnoses in patients who were ANA-negative. So overall, SLE was diagnosed in 4.4% of all patients in the cohort so far. In the ANA-positive subset, the median age of SLE diagnosis was 14.5 years. SLE diagnoses were rendered in roughly one-fifth of ANA-positive patients with chronic ITP or AIHA, and nearly half of ANA-positive patients with Evans syndrome. 21 patients had severe manifestations of SLE, and there were two SLE-related deaths, both in young women with Evans syndrome and antiphospholipid antibodies. Progression to SLE occurred in a median of 3.4 years after the initial diagnosis of autoimmune cytopenia. In a multivariate analysis, two factors were significantly associated with the occurrence of SLE. This included patients with an ANA titer greater than 1/160 at the time of the autoimmune cytopenia diagnosis, with a relative risk of 5.28, and an age greater than 10 years at autoimmune cytopenia diagnosis, with a relative risk of 3.67. Based on these findings, Grinnell and co-authors are recommending that all children with chronic autoimmune cytopenias should be monitored over the long term for SLE. Follow-up should be at least yearly, with ANA complement level and proteinuria screening. And as young patients grow up, special attention is required for the period of transition from pediatric to adult care. Also in blood, a commentary by Ellis J. Neufeld of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital entitled, "Which Pediatric ITP Patients Will Go On to Lupus?" Addressing such a question could be a daunting task, Neufeld writes, if it weren't for this longitudinal, prospective multicenter study that has a substantial sample size. While the association between autoimmune cytopenias and SLE is not new, Neufeld says this research article has important take-home messages for clinical practice. One important point is that the SLE occurrence can lag many years behind an autoimmune cytopenia diagnosis, well over a decade in some cases. As such, some patients who present as older children or adolescents may be transitioning from pediatric hematologists to adult care while they are still at risk for lupus. In some of these patients, ITP may be quiescent, and in those cases, it could be especially important to arrange follow-ups with hematologists or rheumatologists. Overall, Neufeld says, this is a convincing paper that is also timely. That's because an international consensus group that helped standardize ITP terminology, definitions, and outcome criteria is currently considering guideline updates and revisions. So the moment may be right, Neufeld concludes, to express more clearly what is known about the progression of ANA-positive ITP and recommend appropriate follow-up for patients that may be at high risk. You have been listening to the Blood Podcast. For a list of additional authors, as well as more detailed articles and commentaries on which this podcast is based, please go to bloodjournal.org. Be sure to join us next week for another episode. Thank you for listening.